Tribute to Trungpa Rinpoche from Rigen Chitpo.
I and a friend first met Trungpa Rinpoche in 1965 in London. We both had been very impressed by his teaching and asked if we could meet him and talk further and have to get some teaching from him at his flat in Oxford, a flat he called Anicca, meaning impermanence. And we went and we stayed there for a long weekend, going up on the Friday evening, getting some teaching from him in the evening, staying over Saturday, Sunday, and getting some final instruction in the morning of Monday. The most astonishing thing about this period of time for us was that he was very enthusiastic in teaching us something of Dzogchen, or Mahaati, as he called it. We perhaps didn't realize at the time just how profound this teaching was, but nevertheless, it was something that was very impressive and very telling for us. And in fact, it's something that stayed with us for the right up to the present day. His first aspect of the teaching he wanted to bring across to us was a very practical aspect, and that is the teaching of what he called complete openness. He said this is the way that you had to act to everybody and in every situation you encountered. You had to be completely open without having a prejudiced mind to train yourself in that particular way. And that this was the keynote or the essence of formless meditation itself. And no matter what kind of thing arose in meditation, no matter how emotional it might be, no matter how confusing, the quality of openness, opening yourself out to what was there, always had to be present. It wasn't a question of indulging in the experience, but allowing yourself to feel it in a very complete way and then be able to let go of it when you'd done that. So the essence of formless meditation is really the essence of this teaching of complete openness. But it wasn't simply that complete openness was a meditation instruction, but simply he said that everything was completely open in nature. Didn't matter what it was. The nature of everything you encountered, or situations, or people, no matter what the experience might be, that complete openness was the keynote. Another thing that he mentioned at that particular time, he said, is that it's not just a question of things being open, which one might interpret perhaps as some kind of ultimate emptiness, but that things form some kind of pattern, some kind of coherent pattern, just naturally. And this he called natural perfection. And that as things manifest to you naturally in your life and in your experience, they formed patterns that had meaning and significance. In a way, the thing he sometimes described as mandala principle is very important here. There isn't anything, he used to say, that is not significant and not valuable. And there's nothing that you can say about your experience that doesn't make it perfect. Even if you were to experience something negative, then the perfection involved in that is, of course, the fact that you had yourself constricted or interfered in some way with the natural flow and the natural expression of that pattern. And as you did that, then the pattern changed and it formed a different kind of natural pattern that might seem to our minds rather confused or rather negative, but it was simply the natural outcome of one's participation, one's personal participation in the pattern, along with the participation of other beings and everything that went up to make that particular situation. And the important thing in one's life and one's behaviour was to see this kind of natural patterning and to go with that, not in the sense of, again, indulging in it, but to be able to experience it, to open out to it, and then to allow the third aspect, which he described as very important, the aspect of absolute spontaneity to arise. Absolute spontaneity isn't really something that you can say, well, I'm going to be spontaneous. That, of course, wouldn't make any sense. And you can't in any way make spontaneity happen, of course. But it is possible to lay some kind of ground for that spontaneity to arise. And the important thing there is to not have preconceived solid ideas about notions of causality, why you think that the volitions that you have should arise in a particular way. Thus, you might say, well, I think in this way because it's the way I am. I'm thinking in this particular way. It's my own force and my notions that make me think like this or produce these volitions. Or maybe I think, well, it's a series of associations that make me behave or think like this. But in fact, as you allow yourself to open up into that something of that ground from which actions arise, you realize that the actions that you call yours don't arise, in fact, from ego at all. They're not ego-centered. And they simply arise from some basis which is actually beyond thought, beyond concepts. You could say that it's like a fountain of goodness, that all actions are fundamentally good in nature. When it seems that they don't work out or there's some negativity involved, one can see that it's one's, the modification, as it were, the constriction that one's made within how one treats one's experience that makes that negativity there and makes me think perhaps that, oh, I performed this action, I did this particular action. And the egocentricity that's involved in that makes it not a spontaneous action. In fact, he said you had to bring the three things together, the natural perfection of everything, the complete openness, and the absolute spontaneity. They all came together, and that it was possible in the general experience of one's life and one's Buddhist practice to make those three things a complete unity. Then when you do that, said you have the experience of what is called the tree of life. Everything that arises is something of significance and something of value, that nothing within your life is to be considered, as it were, an accidental event. Everything has to do with Dharma, or as he liked to call it sometimes, the living Dharma. He would also sometimes say, the Dharma wants me to do this particular thing, he might say, or the Dharma perhaps wants you to do that. But it's something that obviously that you would have to find out for yourself. But his idea was that the Dharma was alive, and the Dharma was alive with these three particular qualities. That was the basis for him and for the whole of the Dharma, and particularly of formless meditation. As I said, he put this to us as something we should take to heart, and we did our best. But of course, even at those weekends when that instruction was straight from his mouth, as it were, when we went back to the hotel we were staying and started to meditate, we would say to ourselves, well, he said that we mustn't force meditation in a particular way, we mustn't frame it in a particular way. But of course, he couldn't really mean not to guide the meditation along a bit, shove it in a particular direction. It took years to gradually realize that's, of course, exactly what he did mean. To learn to leave alone, to learn to abandon yourself to this quality of spontaneity, to rely on natural perfection, and to realize that complete openness is the only way.